The Chris Perillo Show's coverage of the Desktop Linux Summit is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
We were lucky enough to run into a sister of a celebrity. You may have heard of Matt LeBlanc. He played Joey in Friends, and now he's on his own show. Well, his—I don't know if it's his sister or cousin—is apparently just a big Linux fanatic, Deanne LeBlanc, and she's authored Linux for Dummies, and she actually helped Locker Gnome's Linux newsletter for a period of time, and she's here at the Desktop Linux Summit. So we thought we'd sit down and talk about past, current, and possibly future projects.
I'm pretty sure I'm no relation to Matt LeBlanc.
Oh, you're not?
No, but I don't think so.
Oh. So the name just is just in name.
It just means the white.
The white? Well, you are...
I'm pretty pale.
You know, you've got a tan going on. You're not quite as white as me. I've got white. I'm white. Well, all right. I think we got a good screen tan going on here. So you've been interested in Linux... apparently for years and years and years and years and years.
Since 94.
And this is just beyond your skills as a writer. You actually use and believe in that which is Linux.
Oh, yes. Yes, I use Linux exclusively. I have one VMware session of Windows XP, and I start it about twice a year to take screenshots.
Wow. That you only use it that often?
Yeah.
So you're not big into gaming at all?
I'm the gaming industry editor of Linux World magazine.
Oh, so there's a gaming industry in Linux.
Yes.
I thought it was just a kind of a red herring.
Oh, no. It's not huge and it's not mature, but we do have one. If you look right across from your own booth, you'll see the Garage Games arcade over there.
Yeah, they actually got some neat stuff. So that isn't Windows, that's Linux.
What Garage Games does is actually a lot of the stuff they publish for OS X, Windows, and Linux. Not everything. I think they give the various developers their choice of what OS they want to go with. But what I've found is everything that I get from them that plays under Linux just plays. It just works.
Do you play games just out of something that you want to do, out of a passion for it, or just because you write about games?
I'm kind of borderline ADD, so I like to swap between all kinds of different things when I'm working, and sometimes I just need to, even as a writer, you need to stop and think sometimes and let the subconscious process. And so sometimes I'll just play a really kind of repetitive game, something like Tetris, and just kind of, and suddenly I'll go, okay, I know what I need to do, put it on pause, and I'll go back to what I was doing, and then come back to it each time I need to stop and think again.
I'm kind of the same way when it comes to games. So, 1994, you found out about this Linux thing. What drew you to it?
I had also got married in 94, and so I was watching my husband, and he was sitting there cursing, and, he's got these floppy disks, and he's putting individual files into place, and I'm going, what the heck are you doing? And he's going, I'm installing Linux. And it was a completely by hand kind of thing. And so some of it ended up kind of by osmosis. And then over the years, what happened is I started doing books on it and whatnot. And my husband actually went over to the Windows side for a while in programming. So now he's come back to Linux, but now I know far more about it than he does. And so now he has to ask me questions. So it's kind of an interesting full circle phenomenon there.
What was your first Linux project?
My first Linux project was, I did not choose this title, running a perfect internet site with Linux.
Oh, wow. So was that a book?
That was a book. In fact, I hadn't really felt terribly qualified to write it, to be honest. But when they heard I had anything to do with Linux, that's all anybody wanted. So my husband had give me a lot of help for that one. And then after that, I started surpassing him, and he's back fully on Linux again himself.
So internet site, would that have been about 1997, 98?
Yes.
Okay. Trying to think back into the terms of, where we were with the culture and the web and the internet.
Yeah, it was an interesting book. But I hardly remember much about it all anymore. I've done 13 books now.
Wow.
And that was my third.
What was your latest book?
My latest one, literally Linux for Dummies, came off the press on the 8th.
So, is it on shelves?
It hasn't had time. For Linux World Expo next week, it'll have to be drop shipped, which I always picture parachutes, tied on parachutes and dropped out of a plane in a crate. But it has to be sent directly from the manufacturer for next week, and they couldn't make it here at all.
Are you going to be doing any book signings there then?
Yes, I will.
Do you think, are they going to open source the book, since, you know, Linux is...
No, these books aren't done in an open source fashion, per se. And open source books are kind of an interesting...
Take a bow. They're applauding. They like hearing that, apparently.
Apparently. But no, it's not an open source book, but on the DVD we include... the book covers 6 distributions, and on the DVD we include a form of all 6.
Now, Linux for Dummies... I'm thinking Linspire was kind of geared for dummies. Is Linspire covered in the book?
This is the first time Linspire is covered in the 6th edition.
Oh, wow. So have you done all 6 editions?
I did 3rd through 6th.
Okay. Who did the first?
John Hall and some other people did the first 2.
Oh, wow.
And he also is involved in the Red Hat Linux for Dummies book. There's 2 different books. And so it was just too much. So I ended up being brought in to take over... the rest, and I had his blessing and everything. He sent me a very nice email about it. In fact, I've surpassed him in sales.
Wow.
Ever since the Fedora switch confused a lot of people, I think. And because so many more people are using not exactly the same distribution. So I've really tried to cover. 6 was a bit unwieldy at times, and I worry that maybe it was a little too much, but I think that, you know, I covered Nopix. Xandros, Linspire, Fedora, SUSE, Mandrake.
Wow.
And it focuses on Fedora. So all the step-by-steps are for Fedora at the very least. Sometimes there's also step-by-steps for the, especially for installation. I have step-by-steps for all the distributions for installation.
Whew. Now, it seems that, and I don't live inside the Linux world, thank you. I told you, they don't want me to move. I don't work inside of Linux. Every once in a while, I'll throw in a Nopix CD if I need to test something or take a look at something and you know, throw in the CD, boot from it, and then, you know, it's gone. Do you think it's getting to the point, as far as like UI goes and user experience goes, that it's a lot easier from, say, OS X, which I'm trying to make a closer comparison to that which is Linux, at least on the desktop, what we see, the GUI?
I can't really compare it heavily to OS X, partially because I'm not very familiar with OS X. I can say that Nat Friedman of the GNOME project out of Novell now said that they've done usability studies where they took people who had never used computers before, ever, and they sat them down, one in front of a Linux machine on GNOME and one in front of a Windows machine, and they would both be able to get up to speed on the computer at about the same rate. So as far as people starting from scratch, the usability is there. It's a little harder sometimes to retrain people. And so for those of us who've been doing Linux for a long time, we get a little disappointed sometimes when the UI gets a little too Windows-ish. We're like, well, do something original. But we also try to understand that they're trying to help the people coming over from Windows and not have it be a completely different experience.
As far as the seamless nature of, well, and I don't have that much experience with GNOME, KDE seems to be piecemeal in general. Why do I get that feeling when I use it?
I have to say first, I'm a GNOME person, so for one thing, I know far more about it. I could say that GNOME has a whole UI standards that they use, and they try to, in fact, apparently they have concern their standards work a little too well. Like, maybe there's not enough variety now, but KDE may not have such, I can't say, but they may not have quite the stringent standards.
And, of course, we're talking about desktop environments. Right. You don't necessarily have, as it is the Windows shell, you only have really one choice that Microsoft provides, whereas Linux has various desktop environments, or DE, as K of KDE, or the DE of KDE.
Right.
Is GNOME, is the project, is it still alive? Because I was kind of hearing that it wasn't really doing as well as it used to do.
Oh, GNOME's doing very well. What you might have heard is occasionally when GNOME moves to a new version, people get really upset with them over something they've done. And one thing they did that I wasn't terribly happy with them about, they've got what they call Spatial Nautilus. Nautilus is the file browser. And with Spatial Nautilus, when you enter a folder, it opens up a new window. This drives a lot of people crazy.
Oh, drive me nuts, yeah.
Now, you can actually change this setting. But once you learn how to use it, it actually is not so bad because they've actually got a command for close all of the parent windows at once and then close all windows at once. So you don't really have to go through. Once I realized I didn't have to go refusing, but a lot of people got really unhappy about that feature. So that's probably what you heard about. But GNOME is going very strong. Novell employs a whole bunch of the GNOME people.
Is Novell kind of taking over as a parent for GNOME?
I don't know if I would say that, but it seems like almost. I mean, they bought Symian, and Symian is a GNOME.
Oh, yeah.
A GNOME layer.
In fact, I was pushing for a while. I use Outlook 2000 as my PIM, and I looked longingly at Evolution and wished that they would port it. And apparently news, yes, has broken that they are porting that right after they start the port of Beagle, I believe. If that's the name of the desktop search app.
I'm not sure.
Okay, sorry. I'm like you're more familiar with the Linux space than I am.
Yeah.
So, but I did catch word that they are going to be porting Evolution. Are they going to make it a strong contender against, well, let's say, Outlook or was it Thunderbird?
Thunderbird and Evolution are not entirely the same thing. Thunderbird, I think, is a little more lightweight, and I don't say it in a bad way. I think it's a little less trying to be all the kitchen sink.
And I want the kitchen sink, man.
Yeah, I like the kitchen sink. Normally I don't. Normally I'm a one app, one special app that does something really well kind of person, but I like to have the integration. There's actually a vendor here that integrates, that takes Thunderbird, and they integrate their voice over IP software into Thunderbird.
Wow.
So they can use the Thunderbird address book.
Yeah.
And so you can double-click on somebody with the address book and use their plugin, and then you automatically make a phone call.
Wow. That's
they're
like...
Up over there.
Yeah, I'd hope... I have very high hopes. And, of course, I was following the... Is it the Open Source Foundation, Mitch Kapoor, and Ted Leung developing Chandler, which is like an open source personal information manager. But if Evolution can beat them to the punch, hey, I'm all for it. Because there needs to be competition on the Windows side of things as far as personal information managers
right.
are concerned.
It needs to be. Competition is healthy.
And I suppose you kind of hear that a lot with a lot of people who support the idea of Linux. And that's I can't say... It's difficult for me to use Linux as a noun and because it's so encompassing. It's so many things. It's not just one thing. It just doesn't seem to be as simple as an operating system.
Right. Technically speaking, an operating system is the kernel, and the kernel is Linux. But people tend to use the operating system and all the wrappers, such as all the programs around it, kind of in the same way. So as a technical definition, Linux is the kernel. That's why all distributions are all Linux, even though they're all different distributions. They've got the same, even if the kernel might be tweaked, it still comes from the Linux kernel. So that's kind of semantics.
You know, I only hear things in terms of what people use. Certain people choose Mandrake over SUSE just because of the experience they get. What really differentiates all the distributions?
All?
Yeah. Is there one thing that just stands out between one and another? Does it boil down to support? Does it boil down to ease of upgrading the software that's there? I mean, Linspire kind of hangs its hat on the CNR click and run technology.
Linspire really rules on that front, I think, in some ways. Zandros has Zandros Networks, which is virtually the same thing. I have found Zandros Networks a little more intuitive to use.
I
should whisper that here, I guess.
Oh, it's okay.
But I found that a little more intuitive to use. However, it is far less populated with software. Though Zandros 3 just came out. That may have changed. I haven't taken a look at that yet. When it comes to differentiating between distributions, the first thing I always ask someone is, what do you want to do? Some distros are strong on the server. Some are strong on the desktop. Some are strong on both, though I think in general... a specialized distribution is often stronger in one area. I personally use Fedora Core. That's partially because Red Hat is the market leader still. And so since Fedora is their open source project, They're all open. Everything they do, everything Red Hat does is open source. But since Fedora is their free community project, that's what I use as the base for my books and for some of the classes I teach online. I'm also doing a book on Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which is also open source. And in fact, you can download the whole thing for free and compile it yourself if you have this burning desire to torture yourself.
Your book?
No, the Red Hat Enterprise Linux.
Ah, okay. Just making sure we had a clarification there.
Sorry about that. So there's, when you look at an enterprise-level distribution versus a consumer-level distribution, even a consumer-level server distribution, the main difference there is going to be support and a longer release cycle. Corporations take about 6 months just to plan a rollout. Distributions release about once every 6 months.
Is that the normal cycle?
Yeah, this drives them insane. They can't keep up.
Wow. See, to me, 6 months is too long.
It feels like it sometimes.
Yeah.
But the enterprise distributions are released, say, once every year to 18 months.
Okay.
So they're designed for a longer rollout. They're designed to be, you know, what I know the most about Red Hat. So what Red Hat uses in Fedora is the Proving Grounds. Red Hat right now is working on Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4, and rumors are it's going to be out sometime this winter.
That's allegedly?
Really,
yeah,
but,
right.
Oh, they're close.
Is that their Longhorn time frame?
It will be out this winter. It's very close. It's very almost done. But it's based off of Fedora Core 3. So you can always predict where Red Hat is going with their enterprise distribution by what they're testing and testing and testing and testing in Fedora Core 3.
Now, in terms of numbers, when do you think Linux is actually going to be a contender? I still don't see it.
Well, where? On the server platform, it's...
Arguably on the server platform. I'm talking the desktop environment specifically. Let me clarify.
When answering that question requires a pause to wonder for what purpose. For some purposes, Linux is already very easily a contender. Especially for, you've got data entry people. Banks are using it for the desktop, say for their tellers. Very narrow use things where they need a rock solid thing that will not fall and needs to be secure. They're already using it.
Well, then how come when I go to like airports every once in a while, I'll see like
a
blue screen?
They should be using it, but they also may be testing it. I mean, obviously, they're going to want to test anything inside and out before they trust their whole system to it. A lot of companies are doing, say, a 5% pilot internally. Now, some of them are doing it so they can have a stick to hit Microsoft with during negotiations.
Negotiations, yeah.
And because say, we'll go to 15% if you don't give us a good deal.
And I've heard arguments in terms of TCO, or total cost of ownership, that Linux really doesn't offer that much more than Windows.
Who wrote the studies?
So who
did they get their money from?
Yeah, okay, so just talk to the sources.
Microsoft pays for a lot of junk science and a lot of junk studies. Again, TCO is a very it's very difficult to talk about TCO in terms of a generality. It's a very case by case. You have to consider the fact that if your staff doesn't do Linux, they have to be retrained. But at the same time, you typically do not need as many administrators for any form of Unix as you do for Windows.
Really? Now, why do you think that is? Or why do you know that is?
You don't have the viruses and worms.
Yet?
Yet. They'll come. But the architecture is more solid. They can't... Not only is the architecture more solid, but you've got vendors like Red Hat and others that are adding SE Linux and access control and whatnot. Even in Fedora Core, it's available in the free versions and in the enterprise level.
What are those?
Those are extra security layers. And so you can use these things so that even if somebody, for example, compromises Apache, the web server, you can lock them down into really not being able to do a whole lot. So there's lots of ways. It's just a more... And Nat Friedman in a talk once said that he feels the reason that open source software tends to be more secure than Windows software is a simple fact that open source programmers are working together around the world over a network. They have to worry about security every single day. And so they are just naturally, including perhaps a higher level of security than people that are working all in one location together through one corporate center.
You know, even with a lot of open source apps, and I use open source software, you know, all the time. I couldn't even tell you. My system, I don't even think in terms of commercial versus freeware versus shareware versus open source. But a lot of the projects that I see, they seem to be kind of half-assed.
You get a lot of that.
Yeah, there are a lot of programs.
You get the ADD
programs.
Phenomenon of people who kind of get bored and move on.
Yeah, and sometimes that's frustrating to see a project that looks like it does have or would have promise, and it just seems to be solving maybe 1% of a problem that only 2% of the world seems to have.
But it might solve that really well. But also, see, the cool thing about open source is if it was abandoned, for example, somebody else can come in and pick it up.
Mm.
And this has happened. IBM has gone back and rescued a particular, I can't remember the name now, of speech recognition, speech to text.
So it was easier to go pick up open source code.
If it was a good and it had promise, in this case, speech to text just kind of petered out in general on mm-hmm. Linux for a while, and now it's coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went and said, well, this project had a lot of promise. It has a lot of work behind it already. Why don't we pick this up and run with it?
You know, for me, I see there's a lot of power, obviously, in Linux and what it can do from a programming point of view. It's seemingly, you know, more accessible than, say, the Windows shell.
Because you could actually look as deep as you need to be able, and it's all open standards, and you don't have to reverse engineer anything to make things work.
But do people really want that?
Programmers do.
Programmers do, but people. And I'm not saying that programmers aren't people.
Yeah, right.
Not to make that distinction.
Open standards benefit the consumer.
How?
Because if you have an open standard, you are not locked into one vendor. If you have an open standard, you know, file format, then you can use any software to access that file format without. For example, OpenOffice has to reverse engineer the Windows file formats. It will never be a perfect match. And Microsoft likes it that way. But there's an open source file format they've been talking about here. That the European Union is probably about to standardize on.
Oh, really? What's that?
I'm going to be interviewing that guy sometime today. So.
Oh, wow.
I mean, a little bit. But that would allow anybody to use any program they choose, and it would all read the same file format. So it's all about choice again, and it's all about interoperability. That's a hard word.
What would the Linux community do, say, if a company like Microsoft were to start its own distribution?
That it's rumored they're going to do too, so I'd say about every 6 months.
Do you think it's going to happen at some point?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that just beat all?
It would beat all, but I bet it would be under a totally different license. And like, have you seen Sun's licenses for their stuff they've released? Oh boy.
Is it complicated? I've only seen...
Sun claims they opened their patents, but all they've done is said we can still sue you.
Uh-huh.
They didn't really open anything.
And their Java desktop system is using GNOME.
Yes. And Linux.
Ooh.
SUSE.
SUSE. So it's based on SUSE and GNOME. But yet they have some crazy proprietary things going on. Isn't that kind of anti-community?
Sun is schizophrenic. In a huge way. Don't even get me started.
It's okay.
They're really schizophrenic. They do the OpenOffice project. You know, that's an amazing, amazing boost to the Linux community. Their project Looking Glass, have you seen it?
Mm-mm. What is it?
It's cool. It is a 3D desktop on top of GNOME where literally you can rotate your desktop by 300 degrees. You can take windows and slide them sideways like a book on a shelf and stack them. All kinds of really cool stuff. And they're talking about trying to relate database data and spreadsheet data in 3D and how you would visualize that. So they're doing this kind of stuff. That's open source. And then they give money to SCO. They get money from Microsoft. They attack Red Hat at every turn with the most ridiculous things. Have you seen? They say Red Hat's not open source. Right? And they put out these weird statements. It's like, you know, they give up one hand and smack you with the other, you know.
Hmm.
And so...
Do you think it's because of the size of Sun and its quote-unquote market position?
Yeah, it's called falling.
Ooh.
Look at their earnings.
True.
I do a lot of training, and I do a lot of training for very large financial institutions on the enterprise servers. And I do a lot of training, retraining of Solaris admins to Red Hat Enterprise Linux.
So it's just a general trend that admins feel they need to or want to move away from Sun's operating?
Well, these particular institutions happen to be rolling out a lot of Linux servers. And what they may be doing is not replacing Solaris servers with Solaris servers.
Well, talk about TCO. Man.
These people already know Unix. They just have to be retrained for that version of Linux. And so it's a kind of a half-step training.
That makes sense.
It's a really interesting phenomenon to watch and to be a part of. It's really exciting because you feel like, because of the community spirit of Linux in a lot of ways, you feel like you're kind of changing the world. And my husband often says I should be a professional activist. I'm just that kind of person, so it's really exciting.
Like, what do they call them now? Evangelists. I get cards now that say evangelist. You can actually get paid to have energy.
Yep.
It's like, where was this when I was going through college? I'd have studied for that. I'd have done really well, I'm sure.
Probably have to go to a Bible college.
You know, there are plenty of those lying around as well. So, speaking of Sun and Linspire, they're both working on these projects, these operating systems that aim to bring this thing, this movement, this phenomenon that is Linux to mom and dad.
Well, Sun Java Desktop really focuses on business.
Really? I didn't get that feeling at all.
I haven't seen them marketing much to individuals. I've seen them lots of announcements about there's a lot of corporate features. There's a lot of, for example, a lot of employee identification, security kind of stuff where, you know, you can use it with the data security cards and stuff like that. So I think Java Desktop is really, really oriented toward business. Whereas Linspire is definitely oriented toward the home user.
What do you think about Linspire 5.0 if you've had a chance to take a look?
I have not had a chance to take a look. It sounds nice. I like 4.5.
What do you like about 4.5 then?
I have to say I really like the click and run warehouse. It's convenient. I have to say not everything I installed worked.
Oh, really?
But that was usually it was games.
What kind of problems do you usually run into then?
In general?
Yeah, well, with the games, specifically, click and run.
Okay. Usually they just won't start. I mean...
No, you don't get any error messages or...
If I actually went under the hood, I would probably be able to get error messages. But
figure it out.
I figured it's Linspire, so I don't feel like going under the hood.
Right, you don't need to.
I don't feel like it, really. I could.
And Linspire is built on...
Debian.
It just seems like everyone chooses their favorite flavor and then just runs with it. Do you think any of those decisions have ever turned out to be catastrophic? Say, should Linspire have built on top of, let's say, Slackware?
I don't think that would be catastrophic. I think it would be difficult for them because Slackware is an entirely tarball-based distribution. It's not a... doesn't have a way of really delivering. I say this, I haven't looked at Slackware in years. I don't think it's something that you really deliver binaries in. And so Debian has apt and Synaptic and all that. So they've got ways of delivering out binaries over the network. And so does Red Hat, and so does Mandrake, and so does SUSE and all them. So Mandrake, for example, came from Red Hat. They built that on top of Red Hat. Now they're a total separate entity as well. Xandros is also on top of Debian.
Why isn't there some type of standardized delivery system? Is that really the only... Because that sounds to me, that sounds like a key differentiator if you're talking about a delivery platform.
It is, in a way. There's really two major delivery systems, apt and yum.
And what was that?
Yum.
Yum?
Yellow Dog Updater Modified. Yellow Dog is actually a Mac distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's URPMI, which is what Mandrake uses. But the two major, what people forget in the Linux community is you have to separate the package format from the delivery distribution. Package formats, three. Source, the Debian file, Debian packaging, mm-hmm. and then RPM packaging, which is the Red Hat packaging. Red Hat packaging is used in Mandrake, SUSE, a number of others. And so the Debian's used in a whole bunch of... Those packages include binaries and all the other stuff, and they make sure everything goes in the right place with the right permissions and everything else. The delivery distribution for these over a network, say with apt, you would type apt-get KDE, and it would go grab everything for KDE and install it. At Red Hat, you would type yum minus y install KDE, and it would go get it for you and install it.
So it's like a syntax thing.
It'll go get it for you and install it, as opposed it'll go get the package for you and install the package. It'll check all the dependencies. When you're dealing with source, you have to manually manage all these dependencies. It's a nightmare. I think packages are the best thing since sliced bread. I don't care if it's Debian, RPM, whatever. They're just a wonderful, wonderful addition to Linux.
Makes it easier to use.
Right. And so what's been happening is the GUI front ends on top of these delivery mechanisms. So Linspire with click and run. Debian's got Synaptic. Yum has a few options for Red Hat and them, and from what I understand, Yum is going to be much more included in Fedora Core 4 and the GUI. Fedora Core 3 is the current one. They're not even really started on Fedora Core 4. They're working out the details, what they're going
to
do.
Now, speaking of starting to work on, do you have any projects on the horizon?
I am working on a book on Red Hat Enterprise Linux Server.
So that is it. At this point,
not, you know me.
Juggling many things.
Many different things going on. I do that. I'm covering this conference for Linux Today. I am doing a talk on Friday for Linux Pro Magazine. Jay and I are covering gaming right before you talk.
Yes, I'm finished now with my presentation.
Oh, that's good. I'm working on our slides. We worked out how we're going to do it verbally yesterday, and I'm doing our slides now. Well, not right now. But I'm also... I teach for HPLearningCenter.com, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they offer free classes for students. And I created and teach Linux 101 and Linux 201.
Is that online?
It's online for free. I do a lot of travel and business corporate training. What else am I doing? I'm actually trying to slow down. Oh, and I'm updating Digital Think does the official Red Hat online version of their classes. And so we're doing an update for that as well for RHEL 4.
Hmm.
It's usually busy. Too much.
Yeah. Definitely busy. Well, we should probably let you go so you can continue to float around and meet other people and learn new things.
Always trying.
Thanks again, Deanne.
Thank you.
Listen to the Chris Perillo Show live every Thursday at 7 p.m. Pacific.